Health. I guess we're starting 1 minute early. Sorry. I guess it's a good crowd. I don't see anybody else coming in. We welcome you to a rare summer event with the Institute for Global Health sponsoring Dr. Burke's visit. Dr. Robbie Burke is a professor of pediatrics and genetics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. And Dr. Burke and I go way back. I was on the faculty at Einstein back in the late 80s, and Dr. Burke was working intensively with a senior gynecologist, former chairman of the department, Cy Romney, author of a very famous OBGYN text on HPV. And the important thing for you to realize, HPV back then was relatively recently studied because you cannot grow it in the lab. So Dr. Burke is a molecular biologist, very interested in the clinical and epidemiologic features of HPV, not only was doing basic science in his own lab, but was also collaborating very substantially with clinicians and epidemiologists on these questions, and has been doing this really for the last 20 years. But he also took a very strong interest in the fact that the AIDS epidemic had washed over the city of New York, and we did a series of studies that I think were quite important because they were used by the CDC to redefine in their 1993 AIDS case definition to include invasive cervical cancer. And our work, Robbie's and mine and our colleagues, was very substantially highlighted in that decision. And he's been beating the drums about the importance of cervical cancer ever since. I can't say enough kudos about Robbie. Just do your lit search on him to find his New England Journal papers, his other very high-impact papers over the years. And he's a rare example of somebody who can be absolutely state-of-the-art in molecular biology and genetics, but also be cross-talking to clinically and epidemiologically relevant themes. So without further ado, Robbie.
Stan, I want to thank you, and I want to just acknowledge what Vanderbilt has in recruiting Sten Vermund to this fine institution, and that Sten, besides leading global health and having a real impact in public health, is one of the few people that believes in people. And I would say that Sten was one of the first people that believed in me as a scientist when we were actually both junior faculty. I mean, every junior faculty needs somebody to believe in them. And so, Stan, I want to thank you for really helping ignite my career and teaching me about epidemiology and giving me this opportunity to speak to, your audience here at Vanderbilt. And just to acknowledge how lucky Vanderbilt is to have such a person who's developing new things. So I actually trained as a medical geneticist, and just part of the excitement in working in papillomavirus was that I got interested in over lunchtime conversation with a gynecologist who said that he sees a lot of cervical dysplasia, and HPV had just been talked about. And we tested some biopsies, and lo and behold, like the first six biopsies were just glowing with HPV, and it was just so exciting to see that. And that's what really launched my interest in this novel virus. But let me give you some historical perspective on papillomaviruses. Papillomaviruses weren't always so interesting, and the community wasn't always interested in them. Their history goes back to cottontail rabbit papillomavirus, which was the first oncogenic DNA virus to be isolated. However, there was little interest in papillomavirus as agents of warts. There was a report actually from the Bronx, from Dr. Koss and Durfee, who, as pathologists, noted that some of the cytologic features of women with cervical dysplasia had some features of a virus infection. But that wasn't really the key. The key was Harold Zurhausen. Harold Zurhausen, now, I can see there's some faculty members that or from my generation to go back, that we were taught as dogma in medical school that herpes simplex virus was the cause of cervical cancer. That was dogma. Harold Zurhausen actually went to work with the Henleys at the University of Pennsylvania to study herpes virus in cervical cancer. Seemed like an obvious thing to do. However, he could never detect herpes virus in any of the tissue, and he started thinking about, well, there must be other causes. So have your mind open to other possibilities. Molecular biology, recombinant DNA, was coming into vogue, and that's he used recombinant DNA to clone the first papillomaviruses and use those as probes, and then to really show that he could find papillomavirus in cervix cancer, which was a whole dogmatic change, although it was a slow dogmatic change. So cervix cancer is not a minor problem. Worldwide, it's one of the most important cancers in developing countries. In the United States, it's a significant problem, although cervix cancer screening, treatment, colposcopy is a multi-billion dollar business that has significant morbidity in the women that have these lesions. But let's go back to 1924. This was actually a book being thrown out at Columbia University that I picked up. And one of the things I wanted you should note is that in 1924, in women, it's female the most common cancer in 1924 was stomach cancer by far. The second most common cancer was cervical cancer. Most of this 14,000 is cervical cancer, and you can see it far outstrips the mortality from breast cancer. And I would say that that somewhat reflects the third rule today, but this has been a major problem for many years. This was changed with the introduction of Pap smear screening. However, let's just look at 1924, what they thought were the risk factors for cervical cancer. They thought it was almost inevitable the results of childbirth, the common factors which predisposed to cancer of the cervix. So you can see how thinking evolves. It was known there was a reproductive factor involved. Then it became herpes, and now we know actually as dogmatic fact that it's papillomavirus. And I'm not going to go through the data that demonstrates that. However, papillomaviruses cause not only cervical cancer, but they are also involved in many other cancers, in particular oral cavity and oropharyngeal cancers, and they account for probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of head and neck cancers. And in distinction to the cervix, essentially all of them, or nearly all of them, are caused by what we call HPV-16, which is the most oncogenic and pathogenic type of papillomavirus. So, but then again, there are other phenotypes that papillomaviruses cause. There's skin warts, there's foot warts, there's laryngeal papillomatosis. And as a geneticist, I always have the view of papillomavirus as a genetic element, and I'm looking at the phenotypes by which it causes. That interacts with epidemiology, pathology, and molecular epidemiology, and that's going to be somewhat of the theme that I'm going to be presenting today. So my interest is academic. So what is the genetic basis of a papillomavirus-induced phenotype? Obviously, the most important and medically significant one is that which one causes cancer. So the difference between a papillomavirus that causes cancer and one that doesn't is in the DNA sequence. What exactly is that, and how do we understand that? Also, there's tissue tropism. Some infect the feet, some infect the genital tract. There are different viruses that infect different tissues. Might the genetics of the virus differentiate between persistence and viral load or lesion morphology? How did the pathologist look at the cervix for 100 years and not see that this was a virus infection? Part of that reason is because some of the morphologic lesions are flat lesions, which are very hard to distinguish from normal differentiation. And then what about the cytopathic effects? Might different papillomaviruses cause different cytopathic effects, even if they infect the cervical vaginal area? So to get to these questions, we have to address a few questions. One is, what's the spectrum of HPV diversity in the population? What accounts for this diversity? And how does the genetic diversity relate to pathogenesis? And to a large extent, I'm going to address the third issue of these questions that we're addressing. So what kind of virus is papillomavirus? Well, it's a non-enveloped icosahedral capsid. It's a relatively small physical virus. It doesn't have a lipid membrane. It has a protein-based membrane, which has been very advantageous in the development of the vaccine. They have a small circular double-stranded DNA, which is 8,000 base pairs. Now with PCR and high-throughput sequencing, it's readily amenable to complete genome analysis. However, there are a large family of viruses. Human papillomas now number over 105 or 110 identified types, and there's probably another 100 that infect the skin in other regions. They infect predominantly epithelial cells, mucosal or skin. There are some exceptions, but by and large, the big chunk of the pie is that they infect epithelial cells. Again, their structure, and I'll go through in a bit the open reading frames, but the L1 is the major structural protein. This is what they make the vaccine from. If you just express the L1, it almost automatically forms these virus-like particles which contain all the epitopes for neutralization and protection from exposure. The L2 supports this, but the L1 is necessary and sufficient to form the virus-like particle, which is actually the vaccine which is in use today. So how do we refer to papillomaviruses? So in discussing any virus, we need a common language of how we refer to viruses. In contrast to other viruses which could be grown in tissue culture and might have serotypes or strains, papillomavirus has always been known by their DNA. And their nomenclature is really the type, not strain so much, although some people refer them as strains, but we really talk about papillomavirus types. They've been reclassified into a taxonomic family, Papillomaviridae, with their specific genera, and within genera, there's species, within species, there's type. The only thing you should really appreciate is that HPV-16 is a type within species 9 of the alpha papillomaviruses. And then below, within a type, you can have subtypes and variants, and we'll talk a little bit about this, but the 10% cutoff, so a independent type is less than 10% similar to an already cloned and identified virus for its characterization. Okay, this is now a phylogenetic tree of the alpha papillomaviruses using the full genome alignment. And what I want you to note is that, so this is the genera is alpha. These would be the species groups. And in red represents, within this red characterization of virus, are all the viruses that are associated with cervical cancer have a common origin when we make a tree with all the genetic information of the papillomaviruses. So at some point in evolution, there arose a virus which had a success that then unfortunately developed into the ability to cause cervical cancer. HPV-16 is there, and you wouldn't know it from the crowd that this is the most pathogenic one. So it's not readily identifiable just from a phylogenetic tree. So the point there is that all the carcinogenic types have a common origin, and that HPV-16, the most pathogenic type, is not easily distinguishable based on its DNA sequence and the phylogeny. Now, if we look at a little more simplified phylogeny of the oncogenic types, now there's HPV-16. It's closely related to 35 and 31. But within the high-risk types which share a common ancestor, there are other types which have no pathogenicity, which do not cause cervical cancer. So some have become highly pathogenic, others have become less pathogenic, and some of these are quite common, as we'll discuss in forward. But what distinguishes at the genetic level the most pathogenic from the least pathogenic is still not clearly known. Okay, so this is now the genome, just to know a little bit about the molecular biology. So the E1 is a helicase that's involved in replication. E2 also regulates transcription. E4 has some multiple functions. E5 is thought to be involved in growth factor signaling. E2 is a minor capsid protein. And L1 is the major capsid protein from which the virus forms its shell, and again, which is used for the vaccine. An important point to papillomavirus is that it uses the host replication machinery to replicate its genome. So just as human DNA is highly preserved when it replicates, so too papillomaviruses are very, very stable genomes and mutate very, very slowly. In fact, we cannot really see mutation of papillomaviruses in real time in the population because they use host enzymes for replication, which have proofreading abilities. Just to show you the organization in circular form as it really exists, and in some cases in cervical cancer, the virus integrates, and the integration always preserves the E6 and E7, which are considered the oncogenes of the high-risk papillomaviruses. But just to remind you that it's a circular double-stranded virus. Okay, so what we wanted to do is to study HPV in the human population. We need sensitive, specific, and reliable means of sampling, transport, testing, and quality control. Sten and I really were some of the founders of developing and demonstrating methodology for sampling of the cervix and doing the HPV testings, which has been evolving over time. Part of the challenges in detecting HPV was that it doesn't grow in tissue culture, so you need to either directly detect the genome through amplification, such as PCR, or there's a direct test, hybrid capture, which is a currently approved FDA test for HPV detection, but it does not distinguish individual types. And then one can detect papillomavirus, but as I had mentioned, there's many, many types, and we'll get on to this, that need to be distinguished to understand their natural history. There's novel methods coming up. Mass spectroscopy is the means which you could distinguish different papillomaviruses, but they were difficult to detect. You couldn't use standard virologic methods. It really required the advent of recombinant DNA for their study in the population. Now, the test that we use is based on the L1, which is highly conserved, and there's multiple PCR tests which amplify this region and amplify 40 or more different types of papillomaviruses through either degenerate primers. Degenerate primers means that it's a collection of 10, 20 different primers on each side. In contrast to a consensus primer, GP5 plus 6 plus, which is a single primer, which is which you do your PCR under reduced conditions of stringency, so you amplify not exact matches, and so you amplify a wide spectrum, and there's other systems which are developed and which are used. But basically, we use a PCR system which amplifies a wide spectrum of human papillomaviruses found in the genital tract. They don't amplify all the papillomaviruses, such as the skin types. And this is what an experiment might look like. From cervical clinical samples, these are the PCR products, and this is the beta globin gene, which is a human gene, which identifies that, in fact, we've amplified host genomic DNA, and the sample can be identified as negative, no papillomavirus. And what you can see is it's not always straightforward identifying which band is papillomavirus if you just look at the DNA after PCR run in a gel and stained with ethidium. You always need an additional test. And to distinguish the types, my laboratory uses an allele-specific oligonucleotide dot blot hybridization. These are replicate membranes, and you can see the heterogeneity of virus. We do 40 different types or combinations of types to distinguish individual HPVs so we can follow their natural history. So it's complex to detect. One needs to standardize and have lots of reagents in the laboratory to be able to control for the different types and hybridizations. And there's other tests which are available. There's a line blot, which you would use a strip. And there's a hybrid capture test, which is actually detects DNA through an RNA, and it's called hybrid capture because it captures RNA DNA molecules through a specific antibody. It's a very, very clever and very sensitive test for a direct assay. Okay, so How do we start to approach what the phenotypes and what cause cervical cancer? What are the important types? And for this, there's been case control studies. And one of the questions that we've all asked, well, how do you define a high-risk type? A high-risk type is really important to define because those are the types which have clinical significance. And it's been not a trivial problem, and we still don't have a complete consensus, although we have a pretty close to complete consensus, and that is you can either take empirical data, that which is detected in the cervix, in carcinoma, compared to those which are in the normal population. You might say, well, you could look at genetically related types, or you might say, well, let's look at those that are found integrated in the genome of cervical cancer. My own view is that the empirical data is the most reliable. Let's look at cervical cancer specimens and see what's there compared to the normal population. And there's been lots of data, and there's been different reviews, but the bottom line is, from a paper published in New England Journal a few years ago by Nubia Munez, is that in looking at 2,000 confirmed cervix cancer cases, most squamous cell cancer, that nearly all of them contain papillomavirus DNA, and of those, somewhere around 60% have HPV-16, which is by far more prevalent in cervix cancer than any other type by almost an order of magnitude. 18 is the second most common worldwide, and you can see the others. This odds ratio of 434 is staggering. If you think about the odds ratio of smoking and lung cancer, it's maybe 10. Asbestos and mesothelial carcinoma is maybe 100. So this could be just about the most carcinogenic agent that we know about that we study. And those of us in epidemiology that study papillomavirus are spoiled because we're used to these enormous odds ratios where in most epidemiologic studies an odds ratio of 2 is very significant. However, the caveat is that this is worldwide cumulative. Different countries have different prevalences. And in some countries, in the regions of Africa or Asia, 52 and 58 are more common than potentially 18. So one has to know the country-specific prevalence of HPV in that region to really understand what might be most successful in preventing cervix cancer. A number of years ago, I wrote an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I coined the term a pernicious papillomavirus infection. It actually was taken from pernicious anemia, pernicious, the term is a disease of severe character and usually fatal without specific treatment. And in fact, that's the burden of disease that untreated persistent papillomavirus causes. It goes on, and that's why we have this very high mortality from cervix cancer, because it's a pernicious infection if not intervened. Okay, so what is the pathway of cervix cancer? And then you have exposure. Most of the exposure actually is short-lived, and I'll show you data from some of our studies. This is both low-risk and high-risk. This is now can be SYN2 or low or LSIL, a low-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions on pap smear. However, it's really the persistent HPV infections, and I'll show you data supporting that, which are the true risk factors, which then go to the true or accepted morphologic cancer precursor, SYN3, which in some cases the virus undergoes viral integration and then leads to cancer in probably about a third to a half of all SYN3s untreated will lead to cervical cancer. And this is now a model from an editorial Mark Schiffman had wrote, just to reinforce this model that you have the virus, there's exposure to the normal cervix, you can get some mild cytologic abnormalities. Those of us in the field consider that these mild cytologic abnormalities do not represent cancer precursors necessarily, but they represent HPV-infected cells. These can clear, or if they progressed into persistence, they then develop into a precancerous lesion, which if left untreated will frequently develop into cancer. So now we talk about some of the recent cohort studies that really tried to tease out some of the phenotypes that papillomaviruses cause in cervical infections. Now, this is a study that we did in Rutgers. It was published 10 years ago, but still relevant today. This was a natural history of acute papillomavirus and persistent HPV infection in young women. We called it the HAPPY study. And it took... We had 608 female college students which volunteered to participate in the study. We followed them for 3 years, every 6 months. And at baseline, the prevalence of HPV was 28%. Okay, so that was a pretty high prevalence. We did follow them up. Now, this is the key to the natural history that has been reproduced in multiple studies, and that is over the course of the study. So this is women that entered the study that had a papillomavirus infection. 80% of them acquired a second HPV over the course of the 3 years, whereas those which are negative, about 45% had incident HPV, meaning that over the course of the 3 years, about two-thirds of all the women who were sexually active, most of these women, developed papillomavirus infection. So it's, I think we can safely say that this is one of the most, if not the most, common sexually transmitted virus infection that we're following at the current time. Now, the big news was, and the importance of our study, was that as we followed them over time, we were able to follow the natural history. And this is a Kaplan-Meier, which was significant. And that what happens to most HPV is that, and certainly in young women, is that they predominantly resolve. That at 1 year period of time, only 30% still had their HPV, and at 2 years, only 9% had persistent type-specific HPV. And this was really a very, very important study because it indicated that most of these virus infections would be lost. You didn't have to aggressively treat young women with low-grade cervical lesions or HPV. If you waited, most of them would regress spontaneously. And this actually changed medical practice. Plus, it gave us a new insight into the biological behavior of papillomavirus. Now, here we're getting into some of the differences between high-risk and low-risk types. The high-risk types tended to have a slightly higher or longer duration than the low-risk types, indicating that perhaps there's something genetically different about these two viruses, in, at least in this phenotype, that we can distinguish in the natural history study. And again, just to review the risk factors for persistence, we're old, slightly older age, infection with multiple HPVs, but most important, infection with high-risk HPV types, indicating that this persistence was a characteristic of high risk, but not necessarily dependent on high-risk HPV types. And I'll get to that point soon in our next study. And our next study was a large collaboration with Mark Schiffman and the National Cancer Institute in a study they did in the Guanacaste province of Costa Rica, where they did a true population-based study enrolling approximately 10,000 women with 90% participation who they followed over 5 to 7 years. My laboratory was involved in the study. We did all the HPV testing and interacted with Mark and his outstanding group at the National Cancer Institute. And then this is just the Guanacaste is in the western part of Costa Rica. And just to give you some idea of the study, and in the study, there were about 9,000 women who were in the main part. 629 had a hysterectomy, and I'll show that, in fact, we used these women to study HPV to see if there was a difference in those that had a cervix and those that didn't have a cervix, because these women should only have vaginal HPVs. And in fact, we were able to show a difference by studying these women to these women, although I'm not going to show you the actual data that's been published. This is now, we're going to get to some important points. This is now baseline prevalence of selected HPV types by group by risk categories. And this is all types taken to together, we don't distinguish women that have one or more types. So there is some overlap. But what you can clearly see that this is the actual number. Since this is a population-based study, we've just used absolute numbers, which are equivalent to the prevalence. 16 was the most common in the population. This is now the high-risk types. These are low-risk types. And visually, what I want you to see is that, surprisingly, high-risk types and low-risk types, there's about equal amounts. In fact, some low-risk types were more common than most of the high-risk types. And this was actually pretty striking. We hadn't really appreciated this. 53 is very common, 61, 71 was very common. So lo and behold, that these non-oncogenic types or low-risk were very common. We then were able to follow these women 5 to 7 years later, and we could ask the question, what happened to these viruses? So we then looked at persistence. So persistent meant that you had to have the same virus detected over time to be called a persistent case. And what you can see is that there is 16 is the most persistent that we saw in the population. However, again, there's some difference. So this, although 33 shows high persistence, it was not very common. But as a group, there was no difference in the percent persistence between high risk and low risk types. Okay, so this was a very, very important observation. So some of the low risk types were as persistent as some of the high risk types. Okay, this now is a much larger study than I had showed you before in young women, and this encompasses a much larger age group of women. Now, the key observation is then that given persistence, we really only saw high-grade lesions in the high-risk types. Okay, this is, again, this is some of these, like 66 is considered a high-risk type, and some of these others might have been involved in multiple infections, but by and large, almost exclusively, all the high-risk lesions, SIN2 plus, were seen in women that had persistence of a high-risk type. So this made a very important point, that it was not simply persistence. One hypothesis was that, well, the reason that women get cervical cancer is because they have a persistent HPV, and that's what causes it. And that was not correct. What it is you have persistence of a high-risk type, and it's that causes it, not low-risk type. So a woman can have persistence of a low-risk type and have no biologic morbidity at all. It's only when there's a high-risk type that's associated with cancer that there's a problem. And this is a really striking, and actually it turns out to be that 16 is the most dangerous persistent type. In fact, that approximately 30 to 40% of women with HPV-16 will develop a high-grade lesion. And again, this is the conclusion that high-grade disease is predominantly a result of persistence with a high-risk HPV and not simply persistence. Very important point. Okay, so then, as I mentioned, we also looked at the women who had a hysterectomy to try and sort out, was there a difference in HPV types between women that had a cervix, which is susceptible to transformation, versus those which lacked a cervix. They had sampling of the vaginal cuff. And surprisingly, we found actually 28% of women that had hysterectomy were positive for HPV. However, as I mentioned, non-oncogenic HPVs were detected more commonly, suggesting that this group, which are phylogenetically related, are more likely to infect the vagina than they are the cervix. So there is some tissue tropism involved. It's not absolute, but there is clearly some tissue tropism involved, even in the alpha-9 genital papillomaviruses. Okay, so the point, different HPV type species groups induce different rates of cytomorphic abnormalities, which I'm going to tell you about in these next studies. So then we wanted to ask the question, well, you can detect abnormal pap smears. Are they genetically related to different papillomavirus types? And in Costa Rica, we had exquisite characterization of cytology and histology by groups of pathologists organized by the NCI. We could then look at single infections to determine whether there was some association between virus type and cytomorphic abnormality. And again, this is just to show the relatedness. This group contained, this is a phylogenetic tree, this group contained the ones that were more common in the women with hysterectomy. This is the one, this group of alpha papillomaviruses all contain the oncogenic types. This group actually are those which contain 6 and 11, which predominantly cause condyloma acuminana or genital warts. Okay, and there just to reiterate. Okay, so here's the data that we took women with a single HPV infection, and we asked the question, did they have an abnormal pap smear? Now, ascus means, ascus is a abnormal pap smear. So ascus plus just means anything that was abnormal squamous cells of unknown origin, could be a SYN1, SYN2, SYN3, or even a cervix cancer. So this is any woman with an abnormal pap smear. And in those women which were HPV negative, 8% had an abnormal pap smear. Could be a misclassification of pathology, or it could have been a missed HPV test, but basically a low prevalence of abnormal pap smears. All the women with a single infection, which was our study group, 25% had some type of abnormal pap smear. And if you look at those women with a classified carcinogenic HPV, 34% had an abnormal pap smear, whereas those with a non-carcinogenic type, less than half had an abnormality. And if we break, and this was statistically significant, and if we break down by virus type, and I'll just, the alpha 9/11 HPV 16 is within this group, we can see that this was one of the highest groups that caused abnormal pap smears. Alpha 7 contains HPV 18, less likely to cause an abnormal pap smear. However, this is the non-oncogenic types, and you can see there's a significant difference in the prevalence of abnormal pap smears in women with low non-carcinogenic HPVs versus the carcinogenic HPVs. And if you specifically look at HPV 16 and 18, we see that they, 16, although more common than 18, there certainly their confidence intervals overlap for just causing an abnormal pap smear. Okay. Then we looked within those women that had an abnormal pap smear, how did they break down? So you could have just a low-grade pap smear, or you could have a high-grade pap smear. A woman with an HSIL, that's high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion, this would cue the clinician that this woman needs colposcopy and needs to be identified to see whether they have a lesion, potentially get a biopsy and treatment. But if we're just looking now, this is just pap smear cytology results. So those, again, with negative, you can see that most of the women that were HPV negative that had an abnormal pap smear was an ascus. That's an abnormal squamous epithelial cell of unknown origin, 86%. Few of them had a high-grade lesion. Those with single infections, we saw a shift where there was a few more with high-grade disease. And now comes the really important points is that all the carcinogenic types, we saw 33% were associated with a high-grade pap smear, HSIL. So it's about a third, a third, a third. The non-carcinogenic types, most of them caused ascus. Few of them caused high-grade disease or HSIL. And when you break it down to the two most important types, involved in cervical cancer, HPV 16, we saw that HPV 16, 60% of the women with a single HPV 16 infection had an HSIL, whereas only 17% of HPV 18 had it. And this is actually an interesting but unknown biological feature of HPV 18. It's underrepresented in high-grade disease, yet it pops up in cancer. And in fact, in Guanacaste, most of the women that had cervix cancer that was undetected had an 18-related HPV. So it's a very enigmatic characteristic of HPV 18, which bears some importance in future screening. Okay. So now we want to look also at qualitative load. So this asks the question, so if a woman, if we detect a lot of virus, you would expect that if the virus can cause a cytopathic effect, you would see it when there's a lot of virus. Maybe the difference was that some viruses did not were not in such high viral load, and that's why we didn't see an association. So we really want to look at those virus infections which were high viral load. Did we see a cytopathic effect? Because if the virus has the potential to cause a cytopathic effect, we should see it. And here we have now this, unfortunately, this should be alpha. These are alpha 9, alpha 11. But if you look at HPV 16, so when there was a high viral load, 39% of those high viral load had an ascus plus. But what you note is that in cases, HPV 16 also caused ascus plus when it wasn't in such a high viral load. Whereas if you look at HPV 18, even when it was in a high viral load, it caused an ascus plus. Okay, so it can cause cytologic abnormalities, but the difference is that when it, even when it causes an ascus plus, it is not in a high-grade lesion, and that was seen from the previous slide. I think there'll be one more. So when you have a high viral load, carcinogenic types are more likely to cause cytopathic effects, even when they're lacking 16, than non-carcinogenic types. Okay, so for carcinogenic-containing species, prevalent ascus is significantly associated with a high qualitative viral load. Okay, now, this is abnormality by HPV species group. And let's look, let's just go down to HPV 16. I think I showed this already. Okay, so let me move to the, so unknown why HPV 18 tends to be occult at the HSI level. Could be differences in viral activity. Or it could be a relative lack of exfoliation because HPV 18 is associated more commonly with adenocarcinoma than with squamous. Adenocarcinoma tends to be up in the cervical canal. Regardless in screening, we can expect more HPV 16 HSILs compared to HPV 18 high-grade lesions. However, both should be carefully watched but for different reasons. An important point is women with HIV immunosuppression are more likely to have viral loads, and thus they're more likely to show cytopathic effects of high-grade or high-risk HPV types. And that's an important point which we have time. Later I can talk a little bit about HPV and HIV-infected women. Now, to try and understand the difference between high-risk and low-risk papillomaviruses, we use phylogeny to see if we can sort out and tease out the differences. And what some of our early studies, what we did is we looked at phylogenies using the early genes versus the late genes. And this is published data, but the striking thing is when we use the early genes, the phylogeny was characteristic of the whole genome analysis, but the important point is that all the oncogenic types showed the common origin when we used a phylogeny with the early genes. However, when we used the phylogeny with the late genes, we saw a separation of the high-risk types into two different clades of two different origins. Remember, this is now 6 and 11 is up in this group, and then these others are non-oncogenic. 61 was one, 71 were those common non-oncogenic types. So you can see that there is a difference between the tree with an early gene and the late gene. And what this suggests is that one is that the common, that the cancer causation is an effect of the early genes, whereas there's some other selective pressure that affects the late genes, causing this type of difference or discordance in the phylogenies, which is a very unexpected finding. In the last few minutes, what I want to talk about is I want to focus on HPV 16, which is the most important papillomavirus, which causes clearly over half of the cancers worldwide. And this is the analysis to try and understand what it is about HPV 16 that is associated with cervix cancer. So what we did is we started to study the variants of HPV 16, thinking that if we look more specifically at the genetic variants in 16, maybe we could understand which regions or which open reading frames are associated with a specific pathogenic behavior of HPV-16. So first we characterize in the large population HPV-16, as I showed you. Then we would sequence a region of the URR in E6 for clade assignment, identify novel variants, and then using some simple molecular genetic methods, we could either sequence the genome directly or we could clone it in sequencing to get full information. And again, so this is pictorially, this is the viral genome. We would just sequence this little region, which would give us enough variation that we could classify the different strains or types of papillomavirus. In of those viruses that we sequence, we could classify about 85% could be analyzed. They could be then classified, and we could then get information for disease correlation and full genome characterization. And what we did is we really took a case control approach to ask whether specific variants were associated with different phenotypes. And this is now from Costa Rica and a study we did with Alan Hildesheim, and we classified them into two groups, European and non-European, and I'll show you a bit more in that classification. And what we were able to show is that the non-European HPV-16s were more likely to be found in cancer than European types. And the association in cancer was more striking than that and what we found in high-grade disease. And we believe that this is a clue to the pathogenesis of HPV-16, since within this specific genetic clade, we see this enhanced pathogenicity. And this has been reported in other populations, both in the United States and in Central and South America. Now, in classifying the viruses, as I mentioned, there's no evidence for viral recombination. So to classify them, we've coined a term called lineage fixation. Those of you which are familiar with genetics, linkage disequilibrium indicates that there are specific alleles which are linked together more commonly than others, and that within viruses, since they don't undergo recombination, we use the term lineage fixation. And just to give a pictorial example, and this is an important understanding about how we're going to get at what is the genetic basis for papillomavirus pathogenicity, and we have to take this haplotype evolution into consideration. So here is a genome that has three variations. And say one individual with this virus goes to South America, and then these variations occur. And then within this genome, three additional variations occur. Another individual goes to Asia, and they get two separate variations, and they lose one variation, converts back. So now, if you measure this variation, this is always associated with this and this variation, whereas if you measure this variation, you're always going to find these other variations. So the point is that if you looked at this variation, you could not distinguish whether you were looking at a change that was due to this position or this position, whereas if you looked at this, you couldn't really distinguish it. However, if you looked at this position, this would represent the changes in this viral genome, in this position would represent the changes in this viral genome. So when we measure changes in a small region, we're really characterizing a whole virus genome, and we can't say the changes are due to a specific region. This is, again, lineage fixation, which is equivalent to linkage disequilibrium, and it represents an interesting, actually, analytical problem in trying to sort out the genetic basis of papillomavirus pathogenicity. Now, to do this, we then went forward in identifying the different genomes. We use an overlapping PCR strategy. You can PCR the genome in two fragments. You can either clone and sequence them, or you can sequence them directly. We've now done that, and now this is for HPV-31, and this is just to show you how we classify the viruses. So this represents full genome sequences, which we've picked isolates based on sequencing a small region and picking those which are different, and we can then characterize the variant lineages. And the important point is to see that we would then group these together and these together. We might classify A and B versus C, since this shares a common origin for classification. If we want to know how different the different strains are, we would then, this is a 2-by-2 comparison, and you can see the percent differences, that the maximal difference is just a little over 2% between the two most divergent types. And if we do this for 16, we see a much more complicated picture, but the point I want to make is that, so these would be European and these would be non-European, and it's the non-European which have a higher pathogenicity in our case control studies. And this is just looking at the complete genomes versus the L1 to distinguish how different types are. And we can either look at it in a phylogeny based on this or an unrooted phylogeny. We get the same, the European versus non-European, give you a nice distinct ability to look at two different versions of HPV-16. And so we went through and we then did these types of studies for the high-risk types, and we wanted to ask, did we see an association with high-grade disease or with persistence? So we did a very large study with the NCI. We haven't really published this data, so this is somewhat preliminary. And what we see now is, and this is different than the previous data I showed you, this is in the random sampling of the Guanacaste, Costa Rica population. And if we look at the association of HPV-16 for SYN2+, we see that the Asian American or the non-European was more commonly associated with high-grade disease and persistence than the European version. So this recapitulates the data we had seen when we just looked at the case control study, since persistence is seen in our cohort follow-up study. When we looked at other types, we saw a less strong effect, but because of numbers, we really didn't reach statistical significance, but we certainly saw trends that suggest that even within a given type of papillomavirus, we're seeing continual evolution of viral pathogenicity, both at the ability to cause cancer and in the role of persistence. And I'll just look at, so HPV-18, surprisingly, HPV-18, it was more difficult, although we saw some significance, did not reach statistical significance, as did some of these other types. 39, we saw, this is a high odds ratio, but this is based on low numbers. Okay, so let me just come. So the conclusion from these variant studies are the individual HPV type variation evolution can be generally divided into two separate branches, and the HPV type variant lineages have different genetic risks for persistence and precancer or cancer. However, for many types, large sample sizes will be required to detect odds ratios at 2. Okay, so I'm going to conclude, and I'll open for questions while we still have a few minutes. So I just want to come to a conclusion of some of the work that I presented to you. And let's start with the big picture, the public health implication of HPV. So the public health implication is that we want to identify high-risk types because that's the women that are at risk. So third world, resource-poor countries, this will give us information that's significant for the public health. We can identify the women at highest risk. In resource-rich countries, we really want to identify persistence of high-risk papillomavirus because we know within this group, the risk is really much more substantial than the single detected HPV. So if you had the resources, you could, in the time, you could follow an individual. And as I showed earlier, most particularly young women lose their papillomavirus, and so they wouldn't need an aggressive treatment, but they would need follow-up. So this is resource rich. You want to look for persistence. HPV 16, 18 are really special. 16 because somewhere 30-40% of women with persistent 16 will develop a high-grade lesion. 18 is dangerous because the pap smear is not as reliable for detecting an HPV 18 high-grade lesion as it is for 16. So we might want to give special consideration for 16 and 18. Fortunately, these are the types which are the vaccine will protect young women prior to their exposure to them. So we hope that that's going to change over time. And in the molecular biology of HPV, we're looking at the role of viral variants, and it's going to be really important to see the impact of vaccine-induced selective pressure, how that's going to change the spectrum of HPV types in the population and the pathology that they cause. So again, I guess the conclusion of all medical translational research is the better that we understand the pathophysiology of disease, the better we're able to diagnose, treat, and prevent that disease. And I think papillomavirus field is really at the forefront of translational research in both prevention and screening and treatment. And just to acknowledge some of the people that have been involved in this work, at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Zagui Chen, a very talented postdoc in my lab, plus my whole lab over the last 20 years that have been involved in HPV molecular biology. At the National Cancer Institute, Mark Schiffman, Alan Hildesheim. In Costa Rica, Rolando Herrero. And then I didn't really show you, but I have worked closely with Howard Strickler in the WISE study, the Women's Interagency HIV study. But because of time, I decided to focus on some of the earlier work. And I'll stop here and take questions.